evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the TechNet, which has existed since September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. It usually is a gathering of ham radio operators in which they help each other, educate each other, entertain each other, but mostly educate each other. Good ham radio operators are communicators. They communicate very well domestically, internationally, and some of them, particularly in the New York City area, are very skilled at certain pieces of technology, and they share that knowledge with us. Transmitters, antennas, propagation modes, satellites, repeaters, moon bounce, meteor scatter, it just goes on and on. 26 different kinds of ham radio. Single sideband, narrowband FM, Morse code, digital, IRLP, Echo Link, it just goes on and on. You ain't seen nothing yet. There's going to be more of them developed as time goes on. It's a very dynamic hobby. Wireless technology is something that, from my point of view, is only poorly taught in most of the schools, the engineering schools. You really want somebody who understands wireless technology, you hire a very enthusiastic ham radio operator. That's what a number of companies are discovering when they have that need. The TechNet itself, we claim it's an adaptable thing, an evolving thing, as John puts it, KC2WGB. We evolved it to the point where it is right now, the format it has. If you have a suggestion for a much better format, please come forward and let us know about it. And if enough people agree with you, we'll go to that newer format. The current format is such that during the first hour or so, we take in check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. You need not to check in to say you're listening. After 29 years and something like 200,000 hits on the website called amateurradio.tv, where all of the recordings for the last 6 years of the TechNet exist. After 29 years and not much exposure, we believe somebody is listening. So if you do have a question or a comment, you're going to be giving me your name, your call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. We do that for the first hour. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet, 90-some-odd percent of the time, are the subjects that you bring forward with real questions. Not too often will John or I have a specific subject that we suggest ahead of time. Occasionally that will happen. At the end of that hour or so, maybe hour and a half, John will tell us what emails he has received from the beginning amateurs, the people who don't have a voice yet because they don't have a license. After he reads a few of those emails that he has received that we believe have general interest, Paul, WS2N, will tell us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. So, after our first question and answer period, followed by the questions from the beginning amateurs, followed by NASA news, then we go into the deeper subjects, and that could be one of the earlier subjects that we weren't able to cover, because we make a sincere effort that a person who signs in during the first hour should not have to wait for much more than an hour to get an answer. And even for those who have to get up early in the morning, there's an amazing number of people who will make a recording from the website where the recordings take place and then play that back as they're driving to work or on their rest periods or whatever. So there's various ways that you can get the material, even if you can't stay up late enough. So, as I said, at the end we go into the more serious material, which admittedly it doesn't appear to everybody. Doesn't appeal to everybody, but there are certain individuals to which it definitely does appeal. And some progress is being made. A very long-range project, a difficult project is being pursued, is one of the things that gets discussed at that time. And there are some people who listen in on that, and they find it educational. At this time, I will take check-ins. A typical check-in would sound like this. Let's see, I'll choose somebody. K6DPZ, Hal, and yes. That would be a typical sign-in, meaning that Hal does have a question or a comment. So give me a call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
KB2BHY, James, yes.
Okay, I heard a double that time. Jim was one of them. And who was the other person?
WA2-Papa-Juliet-Foxtrot with a yes.
Okay, Mr. Papa-Juliet-Foxtrot, what's your name, sir?
Vito, like the Godfather, Don Vito.
Yes, that's you told me that last week. Okay, we got Jim, Vito. Who else would like to check in at this time? Give me your call letters and names.
WS2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And do you think you might have a real question tonight as well as the space report?
Time, Dick, but I'll try.
Very fine. Okay. Another call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
EK1NS with a question. Dave.
Got you, Dave. Stand by while I write it down. Okay, we got you, Dave. One last call. Anyone else with a check-in with a name and a set of call letters, because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. I did hear an extremely weak station. Didn't hear you at this time. If you get a chance to move to a better location, we'll try again a little bit later. So don't give up. Okay. One of the things I want you to know, Jim, is that the latest issue of QST Magazine, in the world above 50 megacycles, this is the March issue. The March issue in the section world above 50 megs has a rather nice article on the subject of sporadic E, which was one of the questions you asked a couple of weeks ago. So quite a bit more information than what I told you at the time exists there. So maybe eventually you'll be subscribing to QST if you don't already do so. A good library quite often has QST Magazine, and they also get their issues rather early, so quite possibly the March issue is already there. That I want you to know. Other than that, over to you, Jim. And my goodness, where did I write your call letters down? Wow. I'm Sedan forgetful here. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee. You got it, Jim. K2RIW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I'll definitely check out QST this week. This month. But I have... It's kind of like a question that I asked last week about equipment. I got, for $10 at an auction in my club, the Left Field Amateur Radio Club, I got an Echophone HF receiver that does HF shortwave, it does amateur, it does AMCW, it's strictly a receiver. I've been fooling around with it. I've gotten on 75 and 80 meters, without an external antenna, I've gotten a couple CW signals. I've been listening to some PSK31, but it's an old vintage, strictly receiving AM/CW receiver. And it's an Echophone, and I was wondering if you could give me some information on it.
By way of the people who collect vintage radios, and that's going to be Rich N2EO, Hal KD6D, K6DPZ, and there's probably one or two more. The Echophone HF receiver, hopefully they know what it is. Too bad we don't have a prize, Jim, for how often you can stump the TechNet, because I think you've stumped us. I've used a KLM Echo 70 receiver. In other words, the Echo was there in the piece of equipment that worked as a single sideband rig on 432, Echo 70. And that was popular in the mid-1970s, well before you were born. And I used that for four solid years for doing some 480-mile. Every Tuesday night I had a schedule with somebody in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 airline miles from me. He's 200 miles inland. And on 432 sideband, I used to talk to him every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. Did that for 4.5 years because we just couldn't believe you could send a signal that far reliably, summer, winter, spring, and fall. So your Echophone HF. Let me drop. You've certainly stumped me. I don't know what it is. Haven't seen it. Haven't worked with that one. Haven't talked to anybody who did that I can remember. As you've already discovered, I think various people have told you, a receiver in general, is very forgiving. There's a whole lot of complicated reasons why, but sometimes a very simple piece of wire will allow you to get mediocre reception on a receiver, and a better antenna really tuned for your favorite band and aimed in the right direction will give you better reception, but a receiver is very intolerant, not too persnickety, so I think you said you've just put a piece of wire on it, and eventually you're going to be putting a better antenna on it, and you'll see better results. Also, there's ways that when you bring it to somebody like Andy, WA2CDL, Andy runs the tune-up clinic at each one of the Limar get-togethers, and he brings every one of those at his tune-up clinics, every one of those Limar get-togethers, their flea markets and Christmas club meetings and things like that. He brings along all of his test equipment, and so your receiver could be measured for its sensitivity, its frequency accuracy, its power output if it has a transmitter to it. He's got all that kind of test equipment. So whether or not your tubes are in good shape and giving you best performance, there's various ways of finding that out. Let me drop.
KC2QIQ.
I'll be picking up with you in a minute, Jack Glenn. Let me just get a beep. Now, back in the days before you were born, Jim, every good drugstore in the United States used to have a tube tester, and lots of people in the community would take all the tubes out of their television set or radio, put them in a paper bag, walk them down to the drugstore, plug them in one at a time to the tube tester, find out which of the tubes were strong, which ones are weak. Most of the drugstores were selling the popular tube. You would buy a tube right there if you think yours was weak and it was giving you the problem. And then go back, reinstall them in your television set, and hopefully get a better picture and a more sensitive reception. Because vacuum tubes were quite a bit less reliable than solid-state devices, that kind of periodic testing of the vacuum tubes was required. Nowadays, nobody unplugs the transistors from their rig, probably because they're soldered down, but even on the earlier rigs where they used to be plugged into sockets, nobody unplugs the transistors and brings them down to a testing machine, because properly used, a transistor will outlive you or I, if you know what I mean. Let's see if Glenn is familiar with the Echophase HF receiver. KC2, my goodness, QIQ, K2, I'll give you. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Echophone was a trademark name for helicrafters for their desktop receivers. I'm not sure which model it is that he's talking about, but there were a lot of popular Echophones made by helicrafters. I was just wondering, does he have a model number that might suggest which one it is?
You got it, Jim. What is the model number of your Echophone HF receiver?
To tell you the truth, I have absolutely no idea.
Now, let me ask you this one, Glenn. Did Hallicrafter buy Echophone, or Hallicrafter had a series of receivers? HX, I think, was a HF or HX 129, for instance, I think was one of the popular Hallicrafters. One of their model numbers was called Echophone, or one purchased the other company? Right, you, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the whole history there, Jeff, but I do know that Echophone was definitely a model that was, and there was one of the series of models, and they were either ECs or EXs. I know years and years ago, I used to have one called an EX1. It's a very, very nice, multi-band AM, mainly for short-wave listening. They were actually pretty good radios, and the one that I had actually had the a loopstick antenna that would cover up to 4 megahertz, and then the frequencies above that, they had two terminals on the back where you could add an external antenna to get the higher frequency signals than HF. But they were generally pretty good receivers, nice little desktops. That were, AM, shortwave, with CW, but there again, that's about all I know about them, Dick. But the minute I heard Echophone, I immediately remembered of the old desktop radios from helicrafters. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Radio you just explained is my radio.
Okay, give us a few more words on the correlation you just heard on what Glenn said versus what you're seeing, Jim. Go right ahead, Jim.
It does HF up to 4 megahertz. There are 2 terminals on the back for attaching an extra antenna, and it came with a loop antenna.
I'm amazed. If it goes up to 4 megacycles, a loop antenna gives you some performance. I presume the loop is only a foot or two in diameter, which, by the way, you're going to kick out of the fact that the early television sets in the, let's say, the 1970 time frame, UHF television reception used to consist of a wire loop antenna, which was about 9 or so inches in diameter, a nice round shiny piece of wire in a loop form connected to the UHF converter that allowed you to get a channel 14 through 83 in the early days. Kind of amazing that channel. Those channels started at 470 and went to 890 megacycles, you know, upper UHF frequencies. And here on the middle HF frequencies, you're doing it with a loop. Roughly how big is that loop, Jim? Go ahead. And have you tried any other antenna besides that loop? You've got it, Jim.
It's an internal antenna, so I can't exactly see it. I'm not sure if I'm using the correct terminology or anything, but you can't exactly see the antenna. I believe it's inside the radio. But other than that, there are 2 terminals on the back where you can connect an antenna. It sounded exactly like the radio that he was explaining. Back to you.
VDH with a comment.
VDH recognized. I'll be picking you up in a second. One of the things I think you'll have some fun doing, Jim, I'm going to make a guess that the 2 terminals, one of them is a ground terminal and one of them is the antenna terminal, or they could be 2 hot terminals for a pair of twin leads. If you just get whatever long piece of wire you've got in the house, I'm trying to think now, where's the easiest place you could find? Well, a roll of wire that you find at Radio Shack is one way to do it. In the old days, we used to have twin lead that you could take apart. The household wire that's used for wiring a house, 14 gauge, is a little bit too big to be convenient. But there's various places where you can find a piece of wire that, let me pick a number, is 10 feet long or a little bit longer. String it across the living room floor, maybe out the window of the second floor of the house. If you really got a long piece of wire, out the window and with a slingshot or something else, string it, just let it, the insulation of the wire lay over the limb of a tree. With a long piece of wire connected to the antenna terminal of your receiver, and the second terminal connected to something that's grounded. That's not as needed, but if you did, it'll help you a little bit more performance. It'll be an interesting experiment to just simply add a wire antenna. Doesn't have to be a very specific length, and see what changes in the reception. When you connect that wire, I think you'll find the signal strength meter, if it has one, will go up high. It'll go to a higher scale, or the audio that you hear will probably change in characteristic. Mr. VDH, please give us your full call letters and your comment. Maybe you have some familiarity with that particular receiver, K2RIW. And start over your name, sir.
Okay, fine business. Good evening to Danette, and good evening, Dick. My comment was about the dating of that receiver. I noticed Jim mentioned that it covered police frequencies. Handle here is John. Handle is John, and the call is WA2VDH. Jim mentioned it covered police frequencies. I know that years and years and years ago, the police used to operate in quite a few cities right above the AM radio band, 1700, 1800, 1900 kilohertz in that area. And I know that they've moved away from those frequencies since the, I think the last city to operate there was sometime in the mid-50s. So that might help a bit in dating the receiver. Go ahead.
Very fine, John. Thank you for the extra information. Yeah, one of the things you'll find amazing as you study a little bit more about frequency allocations, Jim, when FM radio, FM hi-fi radio, which is now 88 to 108 megacycles, in the very early days it started off at somewhere around 48 megacycles just before the war. And almost all radio changed a whole lot during World War II, from roughly 1941 for the United States up to 1945. And after that, things got moved around all over the place. The very early television receivers used to have something called Channel 1, which used to tune down to something like 48 to 54 megacycles, which is now a handband. A good portion of that's a handband. But the old television receivers had a channel 1. You'll notice that most of your television receivers today start off with channel 2. And a very logical question is, what and where was channel 1? It's something that really did exist. You believe it's an internal antenna, and I think it's going to be an interesting experiment to try an external antenna, Jim. I presume it's got a built-in loudspeaker. Quite possibly it does or doesn't have a jack in the back where you can plug in earphones and do some listening without other people hearing the sound late at night if you wanted to do that. I used to use the earphones and go down to my basement and turn on my Heathkit radio way back in the early days of my ham radio operation. Sometimes I'd wake up at crazy hours and find out what the ham bands are like.
N2APG?
Go ahead, Dave. Tell us what you know about that piece of equipment or anything along those lines. Mr. APG, the ham radio voice of, my goodness, I've forgotten the town you live in. I should know. You got it, Dave, K2RIW. Sounds like Massapequa to me.
Yes, absolutely. The signal has the special Massapequa code on it that you can detect. I was just wondering if Jim has done any research online regarding his radio, because I did a quick search and I came up with a nice web page which has some information about that radio.
Okay, tell us a little bit about how you found that web page. What did you use as a search word? Possibly you started off with Google. So what was your search word so that Jim can duplicate that? And give us a couple of words on what you found on that web page. What does the picture look like? Got a guess as to how old it is? Tell us anything you know, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I started at Google and I just did a quick search on Echo Phone. I came up with a web page. It's called the Boat Anchor Picks. Boat Anchor Picks, P-I-X, is the title of the web page. And that has a wonderful list of all sorts of vintage equipment. And under the Halicrafters column, the first two listings are for two Echo Phone radios. The first one is in EC-1, and the second one is in EC-1D. And they both are called Echo Phone. And there's nice pictures and a little description of both radios on there. I'm pretty sure that one of those models is the radio that Jim probably has.
I think it's called the Skyrider Junior.
Back to you, Dave, for a comment on that.
Okay, well, as I'm not in front of the computer screen at the present time, I can't tell Jim if it's on the list, but it's possible that it's further down the list. But like I say, the first two listings under the Halicrafters on that Boat Anchor Picks page are both called Echo Phones. But there were numerous listings for Halicrafters there. So if he needs, if Jim needs the actual address for the page, I can give it to him. If he doesn't want to, just do a quick Google search. I think if he Google searches Boat Anchor Picks, P-I-X, I think he'll come up with that page.
As you can sort of tell, Jim, one of the slangs used in ham radio is that an older piece of equipment almost always is more bulky, big power transformers in them, heavy, large, and so we call them boat anchors. As if somebody's going to put a chain on it and throw it overboard and use it as an anchor. Of course, it's a joke. It's not real. Another thing you're going to be discovering is that you live in a very exciting time, Jim. Everybody you know is using the Internet at some ridiculous number of hours per day, and all kinds of information is there. In our day, in our earlier days, we had to go to a library or talk to our fellow amateurs even before there was a TechNet to try to get information. And my wife, who teaches at Suffolk Community College, was having her students read a story where the story took place somewhere around 1970, and an automobile ran off the side of the road, and it was unable to be moved, and the people were sort of stuck there for a long time. And my wife asked the students, what would you do in a case like that? And, of course, all the students said, well, I'd call my mother. To which my wife said, how would you do that? And they looked at each other and said, well, why in the world are you asking that question? Well, in 1970, there was no cell phone. If you're in a rural area and you run off the side of the road and you want help, you got to hope somebody comes down the road because there were no cell phones. Can you imagine what life was like in the dark ages, Jim, before there were cell phones and before there was an internet? KC2, BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Nope, never. I don't think any 11-year-old in the world can.
Okay, before we leave you, Jim, do you have any other further questions? I know, as you can tell, you didn't get a complete answer. You sort of stumped us. You got a piece of equipment that's older than me, I think. Or at least I didn't run into it yet. Back to you for any finals there, Jim, K2LIW. And come back next week for sure.
All right, first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for the information, and Dick, thanks for the experiment that I'll definitely try. Just kind of throw a wire out the window and see what happens. At the auction, I got these two handy talkies. They're one of the first, I'm not sure, but, I mean, they look like the old cell phones, the old big tan cell phones, and one for $440 and one for 2 meters. I haven't tried them yet, but I got them for $10.
Yeah, the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club in Huntington, and I believe they still meet at the new community center. I was a member of that club quite a few years ago, and it's in my neighborhood, if you know what I mean, in my backyard. So you came into my neighborhood to go to that meeting. Good group of guys. And depending on whether those two handy talkies you've got are old enough, it's quite possibly no frequency synthesizer inside. In other words, you determine what channel it's on by buying the right set of quartz crystals and plugging them in. And so that's another thing that modern-day students can't imagine. Way back in the days when finding the right frequency for a handy talkie on 2 meters or 440 was very difficult because you had to buy crystals. You had to order them for $30 or so for a set, maybe a little bit more, wait about a month for them to be constructed and mailed to you. Nowadays, you just flip the dial because the frequency synthesizers are fairly modern integrated circuits, which didn't exist in the early days. Another one of the many advantages you got. The next person on the list was Vito. And so, Vito, what are the smart guys in Bayshore doing today? WA2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Very good, Dick. The smart guys have gone to sleep already. Before I ask my question, I want to make a comment about a statement you made when you first came on tonight, if I may.
As long as you don't offend anybody, you're allowed to say anything you want, Vito. Do remember to wait for the four beeps before you start talking. A lot of us skip over that. You got it, Vito.
Okay, you said you ain't seen nothing yet. Do you know who said that?
Okay, probably not Yogi Berra. Probably not John Burns. George Burns. Let's see, Red Skelton. Milton Berle. I'm trying to think of some of the oldies who said statements like that. But, maybe it's before my time, Vito. Please tell us who said it.
Yes, it's before your time and before the times of all the people you mentioned. Al Jolson, I think the 1920s, 1930s, if I'm not mistaken. You remember Al Jolson?
Sure do. I believe he's the man who, in blackface, as they used to say, made certain movies. And I guess you were sitting on your grandfather's knee when he described that to you. I'm not sure you go back that far, Vito. Wait for the beeps and you got it.
No, I was born in 44. I'm 68, but I do remember my father had many records, old 78s of that era. Okay, my question this evening. We mentioned last week we're talking about switching power supplies. Now, I happen to own two identical MFJ, Mighty Fine Junk, that's what it stands for, by the way, in case you didn't know, Identical in every respect. However, power supply A, when I shut the power off, it very slowly shuts itself down. The lamps and the meters get dimmer. The needle starts to move to the left in the power meter, and then it shuts down. I guess it's capacitor discharging, whatever it may be. And it shuts down very slowly and calmly. Power supply number two, B, when I shut it off, it starts doing the same thing, working its way down slowly. Suddenly, a spike comes up. The needle jumps up to about 10 volts under 12. The lights flash in on the meters, and then it continues to shut down, and then it goes to rest. Now, a couple of things. Number one, that spike, could it damage any equipment being it's below 12 volts? When I have the particular transceiver connected to that power supply, let me give the repeater a break. When I have the transceiver, a Yaesu solid state, hooked up to that power supply, I disconnect it completely, open the cable, and I shut the transmitter off first, open the cable, and then I shut the power supply for fear of the spike doing some damage. Could it do any damage, being it's below this 12-volt mark? And what do you think is the cause of this? I should have sent it back as soon as I bought it, but I noticed this problem. But I have it almost a year now. So, back to you, Jim.
It may not be a problem. Remember now the way some switching power supplies with no transformer operate. The 110-volt line, 120-volt line, gets directly rectified with a bridge rectifier. That charges an input filter capacitor to about 165 volts, and then the switching power supply is doing what's called buck regulation, B-U-C-K regulation, as opposed to boost, and it's lowering the 165 volts down to 12 in order to operate your equipment. It's doing that by the pulse width modulated switching. I am guessing that when that power supply is turned off, when there is no load, the 165-volt capacitor very slowly discharges, and by the time it gets down to some number like, let's say, 85 volts or something like that, the pulse width modulating circuitry has got some kind of a instability to it, and then the fact that it jumps up to 10 volts on the output, I don't think that's serious. Since your power supply is made to give you either 12 or 13.8 volts out, and if it goes down to zero for a while, jumps up to 10, and then goes back down again when it's not under load, I think that is not necessarily bad. The fact that the two of them are identical and behave differently, of course, that's a little bit disconcerting. Let me drop. You could always take something that's a reasonably heavy load, like an automobile, a headlight, or any other kind of a 12-volt bulb, but to put that on the power supply as a load while you turn it off and monitor it. And I think you're going to find out it doesn't do that anymore when it's really under load. A switching power supply with no load at all has a real difficult problem because in order for it to buck the 165 volts all the way down to 13 when there is absolutely no load, you're asking for a pulse width modulation where the transistor is turned on for almost 0% of the time, and that's very difficult. I mean, to turn on that transistor 50% of the time to get a significant output current at the 13.8 volts, that's easy. And then as you lighten the load on the output, the 50% duty cycle goes down to 40%, 30%, and you can see where you're going when there's absolutely no load, if there was no bleeder resistor on the power supply. And that's another thing to try. Just simply hang a reasonable number of ohm resistor, which you can calculate to make sure you don't dissipate too many watts into that resistor. If it's a 2-watt resistor, don't choose the value with 13.8 volts on it where it'll dissipate more than 2 watts. But by putting a bleeder resistor on it, I guarantee it's going to behave differently. By putting a real load on there, I think you're going to find out it doesn't do that anymore. And even if it does do it, it'll do it for a very brief time. So I'm not alarmed by that. even though people call that company Mighty Fine Junk, a number of their products are pretty good, Vito. So I'm not alarmed. Some of the really high-class power supplies have a so-called voltage crowbar circuit. In other words, a little circuit that's about 2.5 inches long and about a half inch square hangs on the back end of the power supply, and you set that circuit.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This crowbar protection circuit, you set it for something like 15 volts of a trigger, and then if anything goes wrong with the power supply, so the voltage coming out goes above the 15 volts, this thing is a silicon-controlled rectifier that gets turned on, and it becomes a dead short circuit protecting anything, because there is a very slim possibility. Once in a while, a switching-type power supply can go in, and even a non-switching type, voltage-regulated power supplies, once in a blue moon, go into a failure mode where they put out extremely high voltages, like maybe 18 or 22 volts, and certain pieces of equipment might not be able to tolerate that. Mobile equipment usually can, because many of us don't do the safety procedure of unplugging our equipment or turning it off before you operate the starter motor on an automobile. When you operate the starter motor on a cold day, and the starter motor draws 200 amperes of locked rotor, at the instant you come off the turning of the key, so you're not using the starter motor anymore, and an inductive kickback occurs, you can get a spike of voltage throughout the electrical system of an automobile, which sometimes is pretty fierce. And as such, most of our mobile equipment can tolerate brief spikes of very high voltages, sometimes of either polarity. So this could be a red herring. It might not be a failure mode. It might not be a real problem. So do a couple experiments by doing it with either a load resistor or a real load on there. But the fact that it jumps to 10 volts doesn't alarm me, Vito. It could be okay. Let's see now. Where did I write down your call letters? My goodness. WA2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, K2RIW. You got it, Vito. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Dick. Okay. What you're saying sounds very reasonable to me. While you were talking, I connected my transceiver to the power supply, and I kept it in the off position, turned the power supply on, and then I waited a few moments and shut the power supply off. With the transmitter connected now with the power cable in place, I still get the same situation. The spike and a little, the power supply acting abnormal, as opposed to the one below it, which does not do that. I also noticed that on the little screen there, where the LCD display comes up, it flashes for a moment also, even though the radio is in the off position. That's where I'm concerned, that damage could happen to this transceiver because of this way it seems to operate, the scenario of it, the little pulse, if we call that a pulse or not. So all I'm trying to understand is that I believe you feel that I have nothing to be concerned about, and I also feel that you think I should not have sent it back to the factory, because it works beautifully, except for that issue. So, do you think I'm okay with this? Do you think I'm going to have a problem? Should I keep the transceiver disconnected and then connect it after I turn the power on? What do you think I should do with this, Dick? And I'm done. Go ahead.
Now, when things were turned off and the power supply is slowly discharging and then it goes into the spike voltage mode of around 10 volts, and you said a light-emitting diode lit up, what I'm not quite sure about is the light-emitting diode that lit up, if it's on the power supply, that doesn't alarm me. If the light-emitting diode on your radio lights up when the radio is turned off, now I am alarmed. So run that one by again, Vito. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. It's in both cases. The LED, which indicates power, and also one for the fan, they both flicker. But the screen, if you can visualize the display, when you turn the transceiver on, you can read the frequency you're on. Well, that flickers for a second, and the radio makes a little noise like it's a voltage hitting it, and then it goes to rest. So that's what's happening. That's what I'm concerned about, Jake. I've done it a couple of times accidentally. The radio's working fine, but I'm concerned that if I continue doing this, I'm going to have an issue with the radio. Go ahead.
K2WOW.
Yeah, go ahead, Bernie. Let's see what you suggest on this one.
Vito, I was just curious. Have you spoken to MFJ? What are the boys down in Starkville say? Is that out of the spec for this thing, or do they say this is common? Because it may have a defective part in its shutdown circuit, and they may be able to point you to it, or it's probably still under warranty.
I have not. I probably can still send it back to HRO. I've been buying many pieces of equipment for them over the years. I know they'll take it back. But it's just a hassle of returning it. I already discarded the box in the factory and so forth. But if nothing will prevail from this, I can just as well leave it as it is and live with it. And yes, I do believe you are correct. I believe is a defective component in the power supply. But anyway, the sole problem that's going to come up with I have nothing so far has happened, even though I'm using it on different other pieces of equipment.
If I understand you correctly, Bernie, I guess you are somewhat alarmed by this, and as you get more of the details, you would be calling up either MFJ or ARO, I guess it is, HRO that he bought it from, and since it behaves so differently from the one that he likes, it does sound like it's something that should be investigated. I'm going to turn it back to you, Bernie, for a confirmation on that. Sounds like that's what you would do. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
I'm not. If it was mine, I would be equally alarmed about it. I wouldn't. But I feel this.
So as you can tell, Vito, looks like Bernie is suggesting that you contact an HRO. Looks like somebody is driving by the repeater at this time. Straight off the boat. Look at my life.
my phone. One in ten hit a Rico. Big head in the pocket. Trying to get up the Rico. I need a way off the boat. 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 I need a way off the
boat. I need a way off the boat. I need
a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat. I need a way off the boat.
Located within 1 mile of the Glen Oaks, repeat. That should make pinning him down kind of easy.
Maybe for the money and the power and the fame right now. She will, she will, she will. Do it.
So I, Vito.
And you can take that to the bank. It's a private bank. You can get it out of the bank. People hit you up. I like the power rank. I'm all about high. I like my girl thick. Not the kind of fine. Eat her till she cry. Call that wine and dine. Try to check me in. I'ma have them checking posters. They think you was wisely. That's why I was chosen. Rockin' like Hasbro. It's a Hasbro. Look in the face of death. It's looking mad off. Now I like my house big and my grass off. I like my girl face out in a north. But I'm raised out to the cold. It's not my
iHeartRadio.com. Custom stations commercial free till April.
Now, whatever, man, DJ Pro, listen.
quality injury attorney. All you got.
Repeater.
375.
What a five.
Now go to them.
He said go to
them. Yeah, I think it's... Roger, Dodge. John, you're reasonably far from the repeater. I'm pretty sure by the strength of the signals that are overpowering what I'm doing on the input that he's within 1 mile of the repeater. That should make pinning him down pretty easy. Input. when I go through 375 and listen on 85, a couple of seconds of delay drives me crazy. To hear my own voice coming back a few seconds delay almost puts me into stuttering. So I don't know if I can carry on this way. On top of that, hearing the people on 85 is going to be a problem, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.